WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Breaking news from the special counsel's investigation. Longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone has been indicted. A CNN crew captured the arrest early this morning.
And the breaking news this morning, the FBI has arrested Roger Stone, the president's political advisor, just after 6 a.m. A dozen officers were told. The FBI agent shouted, FBI warrant.
And federal workers are missing another paycheck due to the shutdown. A fiery Democratic Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado took to the Senate floor yesterday.
How ludicrous it is that this government is shut down over a promise the President of the United States couldn't keep. And that America is not interested in having him keep.
We'll hear from him in just a few moments. We're eager for you to join us to discuss another rollicking week in the news. You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first from Washington, D.C. is Democratic U.S. Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado. Senator Bennet, welcome to On Point.
Hey, David. Thank you for having me.
I want to turn to the Russia investigation in just a minute or so. But first, I want to ask you a little bit about the shutdown, about, of course, the very thing that made you take to the Senate floor yesterday. There were bills in front of the Senate from the Republican-Democratic sides to resolve this. Both failed. There were talks yesterday. What's the state of play?
I think the state of play is that those votes yesterday made clear that there's actually more support in the Senate, which is a Republican majority Senate, it should be said. There's more support for the Democratic bill than there is for the president's bill, and I think Mitch McConnell demonstrated that quite well to Donald Trump yesterday by putting those two bills on the floor. Now it's important for the leadership to come together and reopen this government.
Do you see any signs of a constructive path forward, given House Speaker Pelosi's insistence there'd be no funding for a specific physical border wall?
Look, I think that if we put a clean continuing resolution on both floors, they would pass because people's constituents are so sick and tired of this. And if Donald Trump then wanted to veto it, we could override that veto in the Senate and the House. This is another case of there being a tyranny of the minority around this place where the Freedom Caucus seems to get its way every time it wants, and mainstream Republicans and Democrats are not allowed to come together to create bipartisan solutions for the country. So what I hope is that the leaders do reach an agreement today and that we can go forward on that. But if they don't, then we should have a vote in plain sight of the American people, and members of the Senate can decide whether they want to be on record or not voting to perpetuate this vicious shutdown of the federal government. I think that they won't be willing to do that.
And just to be clear for listeners, continuing resolution being that you'd for some weeks keep the government functioning and open, fully funded and open, allowing a little more breathing space to reach an agreement.
Which, by the way, is also shameful. I've been in the Senate for 10 years, and 40% of the time that I've been here, we have been operating on a continuing resolution, which means that we are not operating the government with a set of budget priorities that actually reflect the priorities of the American people. Instead, we're perpetually moving from one temporary budget to another temporary budget. That's not a way to run an enterprise like the federal government of the United States of America.
I will say, when I was covering Congress 20 years ago, the passing a continuing resolution was seen as basically evidence of failure rather than evidence of success. But times change.
David, and as with so many things these days, you know, at this point, just keeping the lights on in the federal government is considered a success, and that's tragic.
And we're getting reports now that, in fact, the FAA may be grounding flights at LaGuardia Airport as a result of concerns over the ability to handle air traffic control issues.
We're grounding flights while countries all over the world are opening new airports.
All right. I want to turn, Senator, you are on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has taken a strong interest, obviously, in the special counsel's investigation and related matters when it comes to Russia and the 2016 elections. My recollection is that your chairman has said that he wants to hear from Michael Cohen, the president's former personal lawyer. We obviously have news this morning about Roger Stone, the president's longtime political advisor, as well as an appearance today in court of Paul Manafort, his former campaign chairman, who's already Manafort has already been found guilty. Stone is under arrest. What do these developments tell you about what we know about both the investigation, but also what we know about the 2016 elections?
Well, I can't speak to the specifics on the Intelligence Committee, but I know that everybody's anxious to hear from Michael Cohen in the Senate. I think that my reaction to Roger Stone's arrest is that this is just the latest of over 30 arrests, 8 convictions as a result of the Mueller investigation. That's the largest number, by the way, of any type of a special investigation like this that we've ever had. So this idea that the president is trying to get away with, that this is a witch hunt, I think is absolutely demonstrably false. And finally, I would say, just as an American and also as somebody who once worked at the Justice Department, seeing the footage this morning of the FBI going to Roger Stone's home was a reminder to me that we still are a nation of laws. We're not a nation of men. And most Americans, I think virtually all Americans, subscribe to the rule of law, and it's nice to see that process working at a time when the president is so cavalier about our democratic traditions and freedoms.
Senator, I know we promised we'd keep a compressed time. I'll ask you one more question,
sure,
if I could. Obviously, Mr. Stone has been indicted for the question of misleading investigators, questions of obstruction of justice, but also the question of his seeking stolen emails for the 2016 election in coordination with Trump campaign officials. It seems to refer back to the WikiLeaks document dump of Democrats. Speaking to CNN this morning, the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders repeated a popular presidential refrain, and then she tried to turn the tables on the people questioning her this morning. Here's what she had to say about this morning's development.
As I've said a dozen times, as the president said probably hundreds of times, there was no collusion, there was no wrongdoing by the president. What I also know is that outlets just like yours, CNN, spent a significant time not only looking for information of WikiLeaks, but also reporting on it. Does that mean CNN is guilty of collusion?
Senator Michael Bennett, the White House press secretary, says there was no collusion and it wasn't wrong to look for information. What do you make of that response from the White House?
I think the truth will come out in the end, David, and I think that there's no number of White House talking points that can overcome the truth. And the fact that the president has defined his wrongdoing as either collusion or the absence of collusion does not ignore the fact that we have a federal criminal code that has all kinds of potential crimes that could have been created in the 2016 election. I mean, I think that at this point it's obvious and clear to almost everybody who's observing this that the Russians were working hard to figure out how to elect Donald Trump and defeat Hillary Clinton, and made us vulnerable to their dastardly tactics, and we need to make sure that that doesn't happen again in 2020. And I think in the meantime, all of us, Republicans and Democrats together in the Senate, need to do everything we can to defend the Mueller investigation and make sure that he's able to do his job.
Well, that's Senator Michael Bennett, Democrat of Colorado, member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thanks
for having me. Really appreciate it. Bye.
And we want to let listeners know we also invited his Colorado Republican counterpart, Cory Gardner, to join us. He chose not to do so today. Joining us now from Washington is Sahil Kapoor, the national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, always great to have you with us.
Hi, David. Good to join you.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C., Darlene Superville, the White House reporter for the Associated Press. Hey, Darlene.
Hi, David. Glad to be here.
So we only have a few minutes left before the end of this first segment, but I want to dive in about the news of this morning, revitalizing attention to the Russia investigation, to the special counsel's efforts to get a handle on what happened in terms of the Trump campaign and and the Russians, and whether there was in some ways collusion. Sahil, why don't you start us off? What is the import of today's news?
Well, the pieces of the puzzle are increasingly coming together in the Mueller investigation. This is the latest individual in President Trump's orbit who happened to be pretty close to him, a close advisor for a very long time, who is now caught up in it. You had Paul Manafort, who's been convicted. Michael Cohen sentenced. George Papadopoulos sentenced. Michael Flynn has pleaded guilty. Rick Gates, who was Manafort's deputy in the campaign, has also pleaded guilty. So this special counsel investigation has produced a lot of pleas and a lot of convictions and you know, a lot of legal successes here. So it remains to be seen how all these pieces fit together. I think members of Congress are holding their cards close to the vest until this Mueller report comes out. I've asked Republican senators in particular on many occasions what they think of all these developments, including, you know, court filings that implicate the president in a crime as a result of information they got from Michael Cohen. They're all refusing to comment on it until they see the Mueller report. So I think that is when the politics of this will shift.
Darlene Superville, Roger Stone plays an interesting role in Trump orbit, right? He was a Richard Nixon dirty trickster, self-professed. He has a huge, crazy tattoo of Richard Nixon on his rather impressively muscled back. he was part of a political advisor 2016 campaign and then banished from it. Tell us the role in the next minute or so. Tell us the role that Roger Stone has played for the Trump campaign and since then, since Trump took office.
Well, you're right in describing him as someone who's been very close to the president. He worked on the campaign for a period of time in 2015 up until 2016 before he left the campaign or was fired or left under, you know, some unpleasant sort of circumstances. But although he separated from the campaign, he still obviously was in touch with a lot of the folks that were on the campaign working for the president and phone calls and emails and that sort of thing back and forth. And given the investigation that Robert Mueller was leading, Roger Stone naturally became, I'll use the term, a person of interest in this. And all of that has led up to this morning's incredible arrest and indictment. And it also comes on a day when Paul Manafort is supposed to be back in federal court this afternoon on the case against him for lying to Robert Mueller's investigator. So it's another Friday. It's another Friday with great action in the Mueller investigation. And there'll be a lot of focus on this and how close these individuals are, both of these individuals are, to the president.
Thank you for that. You're hearing there the voice of Darlene Superville. We also have Sahil Kapoor on the line with us from Washington. ABC News reporting that federal agents obtained a search warrant for Roger Stone's New York apartment and were seen taking hard drives, other evidence from his residence. We're asking you to stick around. We're talking about this and other stories from occurring across the week. You can join our conversation. How are you weathering the shutdown and if it hits you directly? What is your message for the president and for lawmakers? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're going behind the headlines of this week's news. You can join the conversation. What's your headline of this week in Washington? What do you think of the Democratic 2020 candidate crop? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Sahil Kapoor. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Darlene Superville. She's a White House reporter for the Associated Press. And we're now, of course, joined by On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hey, Jack.
Hi, David.
So I first wanted to go take a call or so. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Carl's online. What do you make of the news of this morning, Carl?
Well, first of all, let me let you know exactly where I'm coming from so there will be no mistaking where I stand.
Terrific.
Donald Trump, to me, in my mind, is a racist.
Uh-huh.
That in itself is not a crime. There's no law against being a racist in America. There is a law about being a spy for the Russians, and we have to start looking at this very seriously. Donald Trump is a Russian asset, has been for a very, very long time, whether he knew it or not.
Well, and Carl, certainly that was something that, according to the New York Times, was reported that something that the FBI looked at. There's no evidence surfaced yet that they found anything to say that was warranted as a concern.
Well, one, let's see his financial records. Let's see his taxes.
Okay.
And if you look at the evidence that's surrounding him, you couldn't bring this thing to a movie theater, to a movie company and say, let's put this as a movie and this is how we're going to prosecute it. They'd be like, no, that's too on the nose. Look at all the people within his inner circle that has been ensnared in his web.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only point to him being the centerpiece. And if you know anything about prosecuting, you know that you start on the outer edges and you work yourself into the centerpiece. And Donald Trump is the centerpiece.
Donald Trump is the centerpiece. Thank you for that, Carl. You know, I want to ask you, Jack Beatty, a little bit about this. You've heard a lot from the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and others. We heard from this morning from Sarah Sanders saying there was no collusion. What does collusion mean, and what? Why does it legally matter to this case?
Well, there's been collusion. I mean, these multiple contacts, I think there's something going on, 100 of them, between members of his campaign or people in his circle and Russian sources. That constitutes a collusion, that is, some sort of open connection with people connected to Russia. The deeper charge and the legal one is conspiracy, where people actually get together and agree and concert to make these connections with Russia, that there's a kind of plan. Whether we're going to get to conspiracy charges or not, we don't know. But collusion and the evidence, the mounting evidence of contacts with Russia, call it collusion, is not a legal issue. It's a political one, and it will, if that's what Mueller finds, if that's as far as he goes, it'll be up to Congress to deal with that.
Okay, terrific. I want to go now to Hilton Head, South Carolina. Nathan, what do you make of this?
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I want to qualify who I am. I am a supporter, a conservative, constitutional conservative. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at these things, the dossier that all the warrants were originally framed on, unverified, it's something that you guys always leave out. These process crimes and these 30 arrests you're talking about, and the convictions were process crimes unrelated to Trump. The 30 indictments you're talking about, the bulk of those are Russians that will never be. In fact, the one Russians that wanted to show up, Mueller backed off and said, oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
You guys tend to underreport all of the true crimes that did happen, like Hillary destroying evidence, mm-hmm. the Democrats starting all of this, and everything from Comey to Mueller and all of them.
And I
issue a challenge to you guys.
Okay.
I issue a challenge to you guys. Mark Levin. Have Mark Levin on your program. He'll tell you what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks for your invitation. I will also, you know, note for listeners, Roger Stone is the sixth Trump advisor official to be charged in the Mueller investigation, including his personal lawyer, George Papadopoulos, Paul Manafort, who's going to be in court today, Rick Gates, a former deputy campaign chairman, and of course, his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. I also want to read, excuse me, I want to read a statement from Roger Stone's attorney, Grant Smith, excuse me, who read a statement about his client's indictment. Grant Smith said they found no Russian collusion or they would have charged him with it. Roger Stone is vindicated by the fact there was no Russian collusion. On CNN this morning, host John Berman asked the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders a very specific question about details contained in the indictment against Roger Stone.
Did the president direct someone to contact Roger Stone about stolen emails?
Look, John, I'm not an attorney. I haven't read through that. Even if I had, I'm not going to be able to provide you some type of insight or legal analysis. What I can tell you is that the specific charges that have been brought against Mr. Stone don't have anything to do with the president. Well,
the White House having to deal with this nonetheless. Let's talk and turn now to the question of the shutdown, the very functioning of government, something that the White House is spending much of its time on, even as many of its employees are not able to attend. There have been questions about a chaotic tax season from the IRS. There have been questions about, NASA and the NIH and others who pay salaries that are not equal to those that researchers and PhDs could get in the private sector for the allure of public service and that being somehow tarnished. There are questions about missed paychecks for federal workers and that correctional officers may be more susceptible to being compromised by wealthy prisoners or by people who are willing to pay them off. And of course, there's a question, as we mentioned earlier, about aviation. The FAA has ordered a ground stop at LaGuardia Airport during the shutdown because they don't have enough air traffic controllers there. And there are delays also at airports in Newark and Philadelphia. Sahil, tell us a little bit. What's the state of play? Like, what is the how plausible does it seem to you, as Senator Bennett suggested a few minutes ago on the program, that there is actually a constructive path forward on this?
there doesn't seem to be any movement that I see at this point. Now, yesterday could lead to discussions in a way that hadn't happened before, because the Senate, for the first time on day 34 of the shutdown, voted on a couple of pieces of legislation, and both of them failed. Now, there was the President Trump's plan that failed by a vote of 50 to 47, and then there was a Democratic plan that failed by a vote of 52 to 44. These, it may sound weird, but in the Senate, of course, you need 60 votes to break a filibuster, and neither had it. Now, the interesting thing is, as Senator Bennett pointed out, the Democratic plan did get more votes in the Republican-led Senate than the Republican plan. So that shows an agitation among Republican senators to get this, you know, to get the government reopened, regardless of whether a wall is included. The president is losing the public relations battle because about somewhere between 50% and 55% of Americans blame him for the government shutdown, and only about a third blame Democrats. The fact is, the structure of the Senate means that that one-third has an outsized power, which is why you see so many Republicans still sticking by the president. Now, a few things that could potentially move Republican senators on this and Republican members of the House. You mentioned airport chaos. That is a big, big issue, because lawmakers fly, their friends and family fly, their donors fly. They're going to be getting an earful from a lot of people if airports are shut down, flights are delayed or canceled, and they have massive lines at the TSA because people are calling sick. They're driving Ubers to make ends meet. They're about to miss a second paycheck this week. And the president's support seems to be eroding among some portions of his base, a little bit, at least among suburban men, among white, not college-educated women, according to a recent NPR poll. So we'll see where all this goes. But there are some signs that politically this is going south for the president.
Darlene Superville, I want to play a couple of clips back-to-back of some back and forth between some of the nation's top leaders yesterday. First, I want to go to the president. There were two bills that, as we mentioned and heard, two bills aimed at ending the shutdown failed in the Senate yesterday. Then President Trump floated the idea of what he called prorated funding for U.S.-Mexico border wall.
One of the ideas suggested is they open it, they pay a sort of a prorated down payment for the wall, which I think people will agree that you need the wall. In fact, I see a lot of the Democrats almost all of them are breaking, saying, look, walls are good. Big difference from what you had 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wasn't having it. She told reporters yesterday she wasn't clear what the president was talking about.
That is not a reasonable agreement between the senators.
Do you know what he's talking about? What size down payment he's asking?
I don't know if he knows what he's talking about.
What about a three-week prorated?
I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means. Darlene Superville, what does it mean when Nancy Pelosi dismisses the president in this way? I guess, in much the way she did when she basically said, you're not coming to Congress, you are not coming to the House of Representatives to have your State of the Union.
Right. Prorated payment. It's, you know, going back to what Sahil was talking about, you know, there may be some signs of movement right now that both of these bills failed in the Senate yesterday, and it shows that, you know, they need another path. The president is still sort of, not sort of, but he's still insisting that you have to have a wall. And he said that up until yesterday in that session where you played the clip from. He said you still have to have a wall. Technology is good, but you still have to have a wall. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are still saying no wall. They're willing to give more money, but no wall. If this was just a question of dollars and cents, you could kind of see where there could be some easy agreement on it. But you still have both sides that are very dug in on their positions. One side insists on having a wall. The other side says, we're not going to give you a penny for a wall. And so it's hard to see how you overcome that resistance on both sides to get somewhere in the middle where you can agree on something, reopen the government, keep negotiating, and put an end to the shutdown and let these people come back to work.
Mm-hmm. Could I add?
Yeah, David? Please.
Yeah. Sahil, Darlene's point, I think, is a critical one. It's an extremely important one because this is not about $5.7 billion, which is chump change in the context of a $1.3 trillion budget of discretionary spending. This has become a larger symbolic proxy fight over whether the country accepts President Trump's premise that the situation at the border and migration and immigration are the cause of the nation's problems. He's blamed that for everything from jobs lost to, you know, wage stagnation to crime to drugs and the opioid epidemic. These are, of course, challenged. The premise of his, you know, what he's saying is challenged. These may not be the right answers, but these are his answers to his base. And Democrats emphatically reject that notion that immigration is the cause of the country's problems or that it's a net negative, which is why you see them so dug in on the wall. It's also, I think, notable that Democrats are not really making any demand of a controversial provision. They're simply saying open the government with what we agreed on. And the president is the only one making this demand of wall money that the other side opposes.
It feels as though on the Democratic side, it's almost become as totemic as it is for the White House in that they don't want to allow the border wall for question of immigration purposes. And they also don't want it because they don't want the president to be able to say, OK, I'm going to shut it down next time for something else. This we're getting calls about this. I'd like to take a few of them now. From Logan, Utah, Abigail's calling in. Tell me what you think, Abigail.
Hi. Well, I think we really need to be discussing how one human being in the United States has so much power that they can shut down the government and has sole say in it. I mean, I know that Congress and the Senate, you know, we have these bills that are being talked about. They're not, they don't have the ultimate power to open the government. Only the president does. And I feel like there's kind of an analogy that this is a version of domestic terrorism. Kim Jong-un starves his people for pet projects to demonstrate his personal power. And Trump is now starving the American, I mean, literally starving people and to demonstrate that he has the personal power to do so. It's a cult of personality. It's a dictatorial kind of move, mm-hmm. and it's not American at all.
Okay, Abigail, thank you for sharing your thoughts on that. We also have a call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Kathy, how is this shutdown affecting you or striking you?
Thanks for taking my call. I am coming at this from two perspectives. One, my husband is a furloughed federal employee. And I also have for many years taught U.S. history at the college level.
Mm-hmm.
So I am sort of scratching my head. I don't really understand framing what's happening right now in terms of sides. To me, what is most important is a profound disrespect for what government does and the role, the essential roles it plays in everyone's lives. And what I don't understand, I know that it is impossible for federal employees to strike. It's illegal. But I would be very curious to know what all of y'all are thinking in terms of direct action. So, for instance, what would happen if all federal employees in a show of solidarity called in sick one day?
All right, Kathy.
All across every platform had a sick day.
Thank you. Thank you for the suggestion. Jack Beatty, if we were to have the federal workforce go all France on us, call a general strike and say no mas or pas en plus, I'm not sure how that would be done. What would happen? What would happen then? Or what is likely to be pressure points for federal employees to leverage against their bosses at the government?
Well, I don't think they have much leverage with Mr. Trump. In some ways, this is the quintessential Trumpian action, this shutdown. It plays to what the Yale historian Timothy Snyder calls Trump's regime of sado-populism. That's a situation in which a voter can believe that, you know, I've chosen you, Mr. Trump, to administer the pain and can fantasize that this leader is going to hurt the enemies more. In other words, Trump is doing nothing for ordinary Americans in many ways through his tariffs and other things. He's hurting them, but he's hurting other people now more. And, you know, a worker in Florida, a prison worker, spoke to this. She said, you know, I voted for him and he's hurting me now. Why isn't he hurting the people he should be hurting? That dark
thread in Trumpism is on display here. So is something else.
Mm-hmm.
That is the president's catastrophic misjudgment. Six bankruptcies in his life tell us something. Those bankruptcies were, you know, essentially he's been backed in the crises, the financial crises of his life, first by his father. For decades, this went on. And then, after an interregnum of a few years, by Russian oligarch money and Deutsche Bank money that covered up his misjudgments. Uh-huh. For the first time, he doesn't have that safety net under him. And yet the habits of mind that produce those catastrophic judgments are still operative.
Well, Jack, I want to play for you a clip quickly. It may indicate why some of those poll numbers have dipped so low. The Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross gave one of several comments this week in which administration officials explained why federal workers don't have a lot of sympathy for him and why they're resorting to food banks during the shutdown.
I know they are, and I don't really quite understand why, because as I mentioned before, the obligations that they would undertake, say a borrowing from a bank or a credit union, are in effect federally guaranteed. So the 30 days of pay that some people will be out, there's no real reason why they shouldn't be able to get a loan against it.
A little Montgomery Burns from the administration there. We're discussing the week in the news. Join us. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're diving into this week's biggest stories, and there's plenty to unpack inside and outside of the Beltway. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Sahil Kapoor, the national political reporter for Bloomberg News, Darlene Superville, White House reporter for the Associated Press, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. I ended the last segment with that clip from Wilbur Ross, which I think may go down in the annals of somewhat insensitive things. Laura Trump, the president's daughter-in-law, made similar comments about, hey, you know, it may be a sacrifice for federal workers, but, you know, it's a small price to pay to advance the priorities of this administration. The president himself said, look, you know, banks understand things. It's fine. It'll work out, perhaps reflecting his own experience in real estate. What do statements like this convey to the public in terms of the administration's understanding about how life is lived? And how do you think it's playing with the president's most ardent supporters? Darlene, do you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, sure. I think the way that it comes across to a lot of people is bottom line insensitive. There are many people in this country who unfortunately do live paycheck to paycheck. And among the 800,000 or so federal workers who are now either furloughed and not working and not getting paid or having to work and not get paid, it's a real hardship. We're at the end of January. February's rent is going to be due next week. Mortgage payments, car payments, you know, the next round of bills are going to be coming due. Today is the second payday that these workers will get a statement that says $0 and 0 cents. And comments like what we heard yesterday from Secretary Ross and Laura Trump and others just sort of portrays a lack of understanding of what real people in America go through on a day-to-day basis in terms of trying to make ends meet and keep their obligations and take care of their families. And, you know, the president in the Oval Office address that he gave 2 weeks or so ago. And even this past Saturday when he unveiled this proposal that was defeated yesterday in the Senate, he didn't say anything about the 800,000 workers who are caught in the middle of this tug of war between the White House and House Democrats on the Hill. He only really talks about them when reporters ask him questions about the workers. What's your message? What do you have to say to them? That sort of thing. So there kind of seems to be a lack of awareness, perhaps, of what a lot of these people are really going through.
Mm-hmm. We're also now seeing a crop of new Democratic figures who want to say, you know what, it's time for new leadership. It's time for another round of people to be able perhaps to lead government looking ahead to next year's presidential race. The Democratic senator from California, Kamala Harris, kicked off the week by announcing she's thrown her hat in. And she did so on Good Morning America on ABC on Monday. Here's how she made her pitch.
Let's look at my experience. I have the unique experience of having been a leader in local government, state government, and federal government. What I believe the American people want in their next commander-in-chief is someone who has leadership skills, who has experience, and has integrity, and will fight on their behalf. And on all of those points, I feel very confident about my ability.
The mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, has also announced he's intending to be in the race as well. And there's this new crop. What do you make of the folks who are presenting themselves, Jack Beatty? What do you see?
Well, this week was the apology week for Democratic contenders or potential contenders. One after the other around Martin Luther King Day came out and said, well, positions I took in the past aren't in accord with current orthodoxy among Democrats, and I'm sorry. I mean, even Michael Bloomberg practically said that. Certainly Biden, Gillibrand, Tulsi Gabbard, and others, and even Senator Harris. And what's going on there is interesting. The party has moved left, and you can see that in the polls. And more and more on the sort of cultural side and on the economic side, candidates are reflecting that. But when they do that, when they sort of try to match their position with the advanced progressive position, they get crosswise with the median voter. For example, Ocasio-Cortez has voted against the bill to reopen the government because it included funding for ICE. She wants to abolish ICE. Well, by, you know, nearly 15 points, the public doesn't want to abolish ICE. The Hispanic coalition does not want to abolish ICE. And then that's the kind of problem that the increasingly progressive party is going to have as it comes forward with its proposals. One estimate of the sort of progressive bill, Bernie Sanders' ideas, you know, Medicare for all, free college, guaranteed jobs, is $42 trillion over a decade. That would double the percentage of GDP represented by government and would result in substantial tax increases for ordinary Americans. Now, when Americans have been asked about this, they've said, we don't want those taxes. In Colorado, in 2016,
right.
Let me just finish this point. In a referendum, by 79 to 21, people turned down Medicare for all. And in Vermont, when it was announced as the key point of the Governor Shumlin a couple of years ago, it didn't even get off the running. It didn't even get into the running because the taxes were so high to support it. The point is, the Democrats have got to watch out for the median voter as they become a more and more quote, progressive party.
Well, to underscore your point, Jack, what I think is fair to say is a lot of Americans do support some of the stated aims, the ideas embodied in Medicare for All, but as you say, don't want to do what might be required to pay for it. You have seen Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggest now, you know, a 70% tax on the top brackets, the top income brackets. And also this week, you know, Massachusetts senator and Democratic likely presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren said she wants to do actually a wealth tax, and that is to tax a couple percent on the wealth of the the most affluent Americans, which some economists say might actually be a more effective way to capture money for the federal purse. Sahil Kapoor, what do you think of that? Is there any way in which the public positioning of Democratic leading Democratic figures may actually affect the kinds of legislation that you see raised in Congress and maybe someday pass Congress?
This proposal from Senator Warren certainly reflects the leftward populist shift in the Democratic Party. She's talking about a wealth tax, which has not really been part of the lexicon. She's saying people above $50 million should pay a tax of 2% on each dollar of their net worth above $50 million, and it would rise to 3% on each dollar above $1 billion. And, you know, this also reflects the message that's going to be at the heart of Senator Warren's all but certain presidential campaign. She is trying to capture the economic populist wing of this party, and it's an area that she's very fluent in. She's the former Harvard law professor. She's written extensively about the shrinking middle class and about bankruptcies. And this is her prescription, you know, to try to do something far-reaching and transformative that would change the American economy and, most importantly, mitigate income inequality. So to your point about legislation, I think we're far, far off from anything like this being seriously considered. But the Overton window is shifting before our eyes. We are seeing the left move the Democratic Party in a pretty dramatic way.
And the Overton window being the expansion of what's acceptable to talk about or contemplate. You know, it's interesting, Sahil. I just want to ask one question. Is this the sort of thing that only plays to a base, or is this a way in which Democratic figures can connect perhaps with the alienated Trump voters who felt economic disruption, dislocation, and hurt, who responded to his appeal and pitch in 2016?
It's a fascinating question, David. I do think the idea of taxing the rich, according to basically every poll that I've seen, plays very well with the public. It plays well with a cross-section, not just Democratic voters, but also independent and Republican voters. You saw President Trump in the 2016 campaign trail talking about hedge fund managers or paper pushers getting away with murder. He promised he would tax himself. He didn't make good on either of those promises, but he correctly identified something in the body politic that thought, you know, people at the very top of the income scale are rigging the game in their favor, and that is also the message that Senator Warren is pushing. They obviously have very different prescriptions, a Warren versus a President Trump. But this message, I think, is certainly resonant. When you talk about something like abolish ICE, the polls show the opposite, that the country is not on board with that. So it's a mix of things. Some of the left's ideas, I think, could be very resonant, and some could be perilous.
Darlene Superville, amid all the political proposals and posturing and other plosives, and also amid the, you know, partial government shutdown that is having such disruption for people, certain things are going apace, even in the government. On Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court voted to allow President Trump's transgender military ban to take effect, while arguments against the ban are making their way through the federal courts. Blue Montana, a transgender veteran, shared his concerns over the decision with Fox 5 News in Las Vegas earlier this week.
We do just as good a job as anybody else. We're snipers, we're fathers, we're pilots, we're everything in the military. And so for them to say that we're not good enough to serve because of medical reasons, they're not educated enough to know actually what medical costs are for us.
Darlene, remind us a little bit about what the Trump administration policy is, what it's intended to do, and where it goes.
Well, the policy basically is to bar any transgender individual from serving in the United States military. In the previous administration under President Barack Obama, some of the rules were changed. And if you were already transgender or going through the transgender conversion process, you were allowed to stay in the military. If you were already a transgender individual, you could apply to join the military. President Trump came in and he decided that he doesn't want that. He doesn't want transgender individuals serving in the military. And he famously announced this policy in a tweet about a year and a half ago. The Supreme Court ruling this week was, from the president's vantage point, a bit of a bright spot in a rather bleak week for the president, with the shutdown continuing and now the Roger Stone indictments today, more focus on the Mueller investigation. The court decided or basically just said that the president's new policy regarding these individuals can proceed while challenges to the policy in lower courts continue working their way through the court system. It's a little unclear at this point how soon the White House and the administration, the Department of Defense, will move to put that policy into place. But as of now, they have a green light to move forward on it.
Darlene, very briefly, the Pentagon put out a statement basically celebrating this ruling in a way which seemed a little stronger than perhaps past cabinet agencies would have done. Is there a sense that this is what the Pentagon wants, or is this a sense that this is the Pentagon, you know, administering the policy of the administration for which it serves?
I think it's a little bit of both. Remember the former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis was not very on board, let's say, with the president's decision to do this. And he tried to, you know, slow walk implementation of the policy while he was still at the Pentagon. But, you know, the president is commander in chief. He's the president. This is what he wants. So the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, they do have to find a way to implement this policy, whether they agree with it or not.
An important matter on the world stage. There has been a movement afoot to recognize as the interim president of Venezuela, the opposition leader Juan Guaido, even in the face of someone else holding the job, Nicolas Maduro, questions about whether or not the elections were fair, whether or not democracy is actually functioning in the state of Venezuela. At a meeting yesterday with the Organization of American States, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talked about America's decision to recognize the opposition leader as the true leader of Venezuela and called on allies to join him.
The time for debate is done. The regime of former President Nicolas Maduro is illegitimate. His regime is morally bankrupt. It's economically incompetent, and it is profoundly corrupt. It is undemocratic to the core.
Jack Beatty, the U.S. not the first country to recognize Guaido as the true leader of Venezuela for the moment. What do you make of this development?
Well, it's a departure, isn't it, from the America first isolationism of the Trump administration. And it's one of the rare times that a Trump administration official has spoken up for human rights and democracy. Mm-hmm. The rhetorical intervention, it seems to me, is all on the right side, and especially identifying ourselves with Latin American governments gives us a kind of insulation against the, you know, meddling gringo charge, which, of course, Maduro has raised. The danger is that it could happen that we're tempted to some sort of military intervention or subversion that would backfire and create who knows how many years of resentment in that part of the world, which has had it with gringo interventions.
Mm-hmm. We have a listener right on our website. Maduro has announced he's expelling U.S. diplomatic officials, but the administration is ignoring that as it's not recognizing his government. Is there precedent for this sort of thing? Darlene Superville, in about the minute that we have left, you know, how rare a move is this by the Trump White House in the face of political oppression?
It's pretty rare to just jump off of what Jack said a moment ago. It's a rare instance where the Trump administration is standing up for human rights and also breaking with someone who is seen as an authoritarian type of leader, right? President Trump has great relationships, or talks about the great relationships he has with the leader of North Korea, the leader of Russia, the president of China. But in this case, he's chosen to break with Nicolas Maduro.
That's the voice of Darlene Superville, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you so much, Darlene, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sahil Kapoor, a national political reporter for Bloomberg News, thank you so much for sharing your insights today.
Thank you, David. Great to join you.
Our On Point news analyst is Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You should follow us on Twitter if you can. Find us on Facebook, too. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poley, James Ross, Adam Waller, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch and Asil Kibbe. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.